Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody to Paranexus Universe. Today is Thursday, October 1st, 2009. This is your host, Doug Kelly. I'm here with Grant Rubin. Downstate, Grant.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the show.
Yes.
Thursday night, and we're all on the edge of Friday.
Yeah, we are, and we have a great topic tonight, responsible research, and our news editor and board member, Dave Desjardins, is here with us to join in the discussion. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks, Doug. Good evening, everyone.
Always nice to have you, Dave.
Alien from Grant. Great White North, eh?
G'day, eh?
G'day. Oh, that's Australian, though.
Get the booted.
Yeah. The whole boot syndrome.
Yeah, boot. He's got that going. But we don't hold that against him. So, tonight we're going to be talking about responsible research and some great points we're going to cover that are just wonderful for investigators, obviously, who it's targeted at, researchers, and, you know, the whole point of this show is to get people to think, you know, just to think a little bit outside the box, think about what we're really doing, and think about being responsible researchers, especially as we deal with clients and so forth. And so, again, the point of tonight is to get people to think, to share ideas. It's not meant to demean or put anyone down. It's just meant to broaden everyone's thinking. I mean, we all sharpen each other, so that's the whole point of this. Now, if you've got some perspectives that you'd like to share, you're more than welcome to join us in the chat room. Or if you'd like to call in and share, you can do that. The numbers are on your screen, 347-945-7799. I'll put that in the chat room for your convenience. You can also use the click-to-talk button on your screen if you have a headset for your computer. The call is free. So that having been said, let's talk about some of these points. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to work off an article, a blog I posted the other day, which went out in the newsletter entitled Responsible Research, Separating Paranormal Fact from Fiction. And there's about 15 different points we're going to cover. Some of them we're going to spend a little less time on, others a little more time. So we'd love to hear your feedback or comments as we go through this. The first point that we're going to bring up, which is probably the most common one, is that relating to orbs, the belief that some or all of orbs are spirits or ghosts. Now, we've obviously talked about this on the show before, and let's just get comments. Let's start with Dave. What do you think about that, Dave?
I'm thinking there's a can of worms here. A lot of people that I've talked to, they all hold the same belief that anything that is photographed or videoed that is anomalous and orb shaped is in fact a spirit. I'm saying prove it. I mean, there's way too much in airborne contamination to contribute anything that, you know, anything orb-shaped, unless it comes up right to my face and starts speaking in tongues or singing Swanee.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, I'm not going to believe it, though.
Well, you know, the idea is that energy, the easiest way for energy to manifest is in a sphere. And, of course, since pictures are two-dimensional, it shows up as an orb. You know, there's also another common belief that an orb is not a spirit unless it's producing light, unless light is emanating from it. The obvious question is, well, how do you know whether it's, you know, giving off light or whether that's just a reflection from the flash on dust? And so I agree, you know, if an orb is a spirit, you know, hey, I want to believe too. Prove it. You know, why would that be a spirit? What reason and basis is there to believe that a light anomaly or a dust anomaly is a spirit? There just isn't any basis there. One of the points I talk about in my article is two different standards that are used in the court system. And one of them is considered a lesser standard that's used in civil cases. It's known as the preponderance of evidence. And it simply means more likely true than not true. The second standard is a higher standard, the highest, used in criminal cases, and it's known as beyond a reasonable doubt. And that simply means that no reasonable doubt in the mind of a reasonable person. And so as we go through some of these different myths and separating fact from fiction, bear that in mind. When it comes to orbs, the preponderance of evidence beyond a shadow of a doubt is that they are airborne contaminants, and primarily resulting from these small consumer compact flash cameras where the flash is located close to the lens. You get a little better camera where the flash is a little bit further away from it, and your orbs go away.
By using an off-camera flash or no flash at all, I mean, you can pretty much eliminate orbs completely.
Cool. Any comments, Grant, on number one here?
No, I'm pretty much in agreement. I think that we all know that the contaminants in the air, we've talked about how the flash can cause reflections. I just can't. It just seems to me most of the time it's just particulates in the air and they're reflecting. I have not seen anything that would lead me to believe anything otherwise. But, you know, one of the things I did want to say a little bit earlier when your time when the show started was, you know, I know that all three of us would welcome anybody who wants to come onto the show or he wants to call in or in the chat room that wants to challenge us. And, you know, if you want to challenge us on it, the atmosphere is, you're welcome to do so. We would say to you, like in any scientific debate, bring forth your evidence to let us all take a look at it. And, you know, if you can prove us wrong, well, then my hat's off to you.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you might even eat his hat.
Yeah. I'll eat my Devil Rays hat, you know, I mean, my Rays cap, and, you know, be happy to do so. If you can prove to me that there's actually a face in there and it's legitimate and what we're seeing is a spirit.
And that is a legitimate.
A lot of people will argue, you know, well, my house or my business or whatever, it's not dusty. Well, you know, I beg to differ. Unless you live in a vacuum or, you know, have absolutely no windows or doors, you're going to have dust regardless.
Amen. So, you know, again, the challenge that Grant offered is not, it's a real challenge. I mean, hey, if some of these things, some of these orbs are spirits, we want to know. We want to believe, too. We just don't have any basis at this point. So let's move on to point number two. This is myth number two, that light streaks that you see sometimes in these photographs are spirits or some kind of a paranormal phenomena. However, they're not. Light streaks are caused by camera shake, minute movement of the camera. And people say, yeah, but the whole picture's in focus. You ever gotten any of those, Dave?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Even with your camera mounted firmly on a tripod and bricked down, you're still at risk for camera shakes, especially with longer exposures.
Yeah.
I mean, trucks going by on the road outside cause small seismic, you know, events within the residence and on the floorboards and through the foundation. So you're not going to be without camera shake unless, again, you're living in a vacuum and
right? No movement. But, and it can be so minute that you don't even realize you did it. And another thing that's very common is when you're, you know, if you're researching at night, so it's all dark, your camera's in the auto mode, it's going to automatically select a longer exposure time. And if you take your picture, snap your picture, and then drop your camera down like we do so often, that can cause camera shake where everything appears in focus except bright lights or reflected lights are streaked. And if you have more than one light source, a telltale sign is that both light sources will follow the same track. They'll be identical, and the streak will look identical, one streak to the other, or very close to it, depending on how bright it was. So use a tripod or a monopod. Be aware that if you're taking pictures in the dark, your exposure time is going to automatically get longer, and you can reduce camera shake that way. Three and four are both myths regarding mists. One is these misty clouds of light that you see sometimes during daytime photos. We've had some of those come through. And it's just like a misty light, and it looks like almost like a spirit trying to manifest. That's one. The other one, number four, is mists that we see at night. Sometimes you'll take photographs, and there'll be this mist there. Those two are dubious at best. The one in the daytime almost always is a light anomaly. In fact, the way to check it is if the sun is in front of the camera, even if it's out of view, you're probably going to get some lens flare. So look for shadows. Which way are they going? And it could be the sun reflecting off of something else, like a window, a car window. Even if you're facing away from the sun, if there's a bright light source, even off out of view of the picture, you're probably going to get light anomalies. So those are just almost always light anomalies. So not enough there. I don't know, Dave, have you ever caught any mists at night?
No. Most of the stuff that we witnessed is your orb and rod stuff. Excuse me, going back and touching on the lens flares, a good way of getting rid of lens flares at any time, whether day or night, is by using a lens shade on, well, especially for DSLR cameras.
Mm-hmm.
Go to a camera shop and you can get a cheap lens shade that just screws onto the front of the lens, and it cuts down any ambient light that might get reflected off and into the lens.
That's a good suggestion. And, you know, lens flare can even happen in the dark, too. So, you know, look for reflections off from the flash, off of glass or cabinets or any kind of mirrors or anything. Look for those. As far as mists at night, I will tell you that I have gotten a couple of very interesting ones. One was taken, there was a mist there. Another picture was taken about 56 seconds later. It was gone. I know Yari Nicola took one in a cemetery. 14 seconds later, took another one. It was there the first time, was not there the second time. The problem with these types of things is ruling out atmospheric conditions. So you really have to take a lot into account, humidity, dew point, and if it's cold where you're at, you know, there's exhaled breath, there's even just warm air in the cold.
The effects of the temperature on the camera.
Yeah.
If you take your camera right out of a warm vehicle into a cold environment, you're going to start frosting up, and that can cause all sorts of nightmares too.
Yes, so, you know, if you're going out, be sure your equipment's not left in the cold for a long time, and then you go inside, I mean, your lens will frost up for a while until it warms up. Any comments on that, Grant?
No, I'm in full agreement. You know, I recall distinctly when we had a gentleman approach us a couple of years ago, and in the very case that you guys were just talking about, where he took pictures, he thought his daughter had some special abilities, because everywhere he took pictures of her, there were orbs. And the case was, he brought the camera from the warm house outside, and he did let it cool off for a little while, but apparently it wasn't long enough because there were all kinds of orbs all over the place. And it was obvious it was condensation of some kind. But, you know, he was firm in his belief. We couldn't convince him otherwise.
No, it was belief.
Pardon me?
Those beliefs, you know, I mean.
Yeah, well, no, he was not going to be fazed. He thought his daughter was gifted and had all these spiritual orbs around her. So it was just like, well, okay, well, good luck. Try to explain the camera that way. But I think a lot of times it does happen. And most folks who aren't as familiar with it, and they don't look for it to be a natural cause like a scientist would. They look at it as it's something spiritual right away off the bat. And that's what distinguishes us from some of the other groups out there, from quite a few of them.
If you think about it, you know, if we're at a baseball stadium watching a game and we take a picture and we get this funky, you know, misty thing trying to appear, are we going to automatically assume it's a ghost or a spirit? Probably not. I mean, we're in a whole different environment, different purpose. But yet somehow when we go on an investigation, if we get anything that looks weird or that we can't quickly explain, we automatically want to assume that it's somehow paranormal. That's just not, there's no basis for that. You know, what would we think of it, of the picture or the video if we caught it in a completely different environment? We've got a little bit of Skype issue that should pass momentarily.
Yeah, bear with us, folks. Doug was, once again this week, despite all of his warnings, Doug busted out his Ouija board.
And I pissed off this guy.
Doug, put it down. See?
It's not my fault this week. Dave's been playing with a Ouija board this week.
No, not my fault this time.
Okay.
I've got my foil hat on. So
blame it on.
Okay, let's go to the next one, number five. The myth is that faces appear in objects or on walls. You know, again, this is almost always due to pareidolia, which is a form of apophenia, or matrixing is probably a more common word for it in the community. You know, you got to be very careful when you start seeing faces and things that it's not light refraction, that just the way that the item looks when photographed with a flash. You know, we apophenia is, in matrixing, is really the mind's attempt to make order out of disorder. So, I mean, there has got to be some awfully compelling evidence, and, I mean, it is so rare that it's almost not even an issue. Number six, one of my favorites, is demons and demonology. We talked about that on the program before. However, in recent times, we've taken a little bit more of a firm stance on the topic of demons and demonology. And just to give a brief history, I mean, demons have been around in different cultures since, you know, time began, or at least humans began. And the bottom line is that demonology is a religious construct. It's part of religion. It's not necessarily real. Now, I'm not saying that there might not be some malevolent entities out there. I mean, there's some evidence to suggest that. But to go out on a limb and call them demons or elementals or trolls or fairies or whatever is without basis. And, you know, there's just no argument for them. And a lot of people come up with, well, you know, what did I just exercise the other night if it wasn't a demon? Well, there's some theories on that that directly relate to psychology. And, Grant, if you have any comments on this or my Dave.
Well, maybe there's just exercising or externalizing their own demons.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's honestly, I mean, we're not debunkers here. I mean, we're not the hardline negativists here. All we're saying is that what is it about that scenario that would tell us it's not some part of psychology? It could be rooted in some schizophrenia. It could be It could be a number of things. Why automatically assume that some malevolent fallen angel is trying to take over a person?
A lot of it has to do with the whole Hollywood, the Hollywood syndrome. I mean, the human mind is a powerful, powerful thing. And even just a simple suggestion towards the negative can seem to thoughts to...
We're losing you, Dave.
Hello now. Can you hear me now?
We can hear you, but there's some static there.
You sound a little bit better now.
Yeah, try it again.
All right.
Shift your tin hat the other side.
Yeah.
Got a glue.
So you're not supposed to tell the audience our secret, Doug. That's we're all wearing the snacks that are covered in baby oil. It's the only way to be protected from the cosmic rays.
I just have to glue more pennies onto it and hope for the best.
Absolutely. That was my secret.
Anyways, the power of suggestion to the human mind. I mean, even the slightest can skew someone's thoughts and opinions on anything to an extreme where, you know, everything becomes negative.
Yeah, sure. You know, there's in hypnosis, there's this thing called parts therapy. It's a approach to helping people get past their problems, the things that are holding them back. And we've done this all the time. Maybe when faced with a heavy decision, we say, you know, well, part of me wants to do this, but another part of me thinks I should do this. You know, we do that all the time. And yet we're not trying to say, yeah, we've got multiple personality disorder. We're just saying that there are different aspects of our thinking. Well, it's interesting in hypnosis when you do parts therapy, and you have somebody under hypnosis, and you ask to bring forth that part of them that is causing the issue, and you communicate with that, and you try to resolve those issues. And it's interesting how effective that can be. And my hunch, my theory on being possessed is similar to that. It's the mind's response to stress. Is it true with everybody? No. Is it more on the rare side? Yes. But couldn't it possibly be that? Why not rule out the psychology, the more common things, before we get out on the lurch with demons? And so we just don't do demons. We don't do demonology. We don't consider it to be a legitimate form of paranormal research. I know people that would argue with me to the death on that, and that's fine. It's just the way we approach things. We can't prove demons. Now, we can't go anywhere with it. If we believe in demons, that means we believe in God, and that demons are fallen angels, and that there's this big battle between God and demons and Satan and all that. And that's just not everybody's belief system. I mean, some people have it. That's fine. It's their belief system. But it doesn't give us any scientific basis to go on.
It's like you alluded to in the article, Doug. It's based on religious construct, and religion has no real... factor in science, although some would beg to differ.
Right. Well, religion is faith-based. It's subjective by nature. Science is objective. It's not faith-based. And, you know, me, from anybody who's read anything I've written in the CPI course and other things, you know, I think that science and religion, the extremes, are two sides of the same coin. They're both closed-minded in different ways. The idea is to be in the middle. Don't hold preconceived ideas that are not, you know, or ideas that are based on nothing.
Doug, it's like when you approach an investigation, you have to approach it like you've got a flow chart. You know, when you come to your first crossroads, if the answer is a yes or no on a question, you think they're psychological. If yes, go to B. You know, you've got to approach it in that kind of a manner. It can't be one of those things where you automatically make an assumption on something that's basically thin air. You have to rule out all the possible variables before you can even come to a conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Before you can even approach a paranormal
conclusion. That's right. Absolutely.
Now, in the chat room, Dundee makes a comment, I'm assuming, on this demonology part, Do you think that it was first instituted to help primitive man discern between good and bad, whether it be character, luck, etc., that kind of thing? And I do. I mean, obviously, and I'm not alone in this, that if you've got some stuff going on that you just can't explain, you know, think about during the Dark Ages, Middle Ages, think about previous to that, even before, you know, the first century B.C. How are we going to explain this? We don't have the science that we have today. How do we explain some of these funky things, especially if I'm religious and some stuff's floating around or things are moving of its own or I feel threatened? How easy it is.
Well, the crops have failed for this season, so you
sure.
explain it away.
The gods are angry.
The gods are angry or it's another way, a very easy way to control the population. Let's say, you know, like you're a young, Mesopotamia or a place like that where everybody had to work for the common good of the community. And guess what? If you're outside the lines, well, you just might not get fed.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to remember, too, that it's an institution as well. You know, whether it's religion or science, and the purpose of an institution is to keep people within the confines of that institution.
It's another way of promulgating fear as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we're getting
and
to
control.
That. We're getting to that in the next myth, too. So, suffice it to say, the only demons we can prove are the ones that exist between our ears.
There you go.
So, let's go on to number seven, myth number seven. Ghosts, spirits, and demons can hurt you. Anybody want to start out that discussion?
Well, I imagine if you have an incredible anxiety disorder reaction, you could trip and fall down the stairs and break your neck. Or if you were so filled with fear, the way you'd be harmed would not be from the spirit, but from your own reaction to what you perceive of as something supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way they could harm you, in my opinion.
Dave, any comments on that one?
I don't have a whole lot to say on that one. I like what you had at the bottom, though, to be careful about tripping over something. The only real danger is tripping over something in the dark, which, yeah, that's...
yeah.
Well, all of us have been startled, you know? All of us can be startled, but that doesn't mean there's a ghost jumping. It's that dude run in the dark.
Again, it also boils down to psychological effects. I mean, it's been proven that the brain is capable of manifesting injuries or, you know, bruising.
Yes, psychosomatic
injuries based on suggestion. So, again, you know, it's something else.
It's called parenting.
So again, you know, it's another psychological issue that you have to take into consideration.
Well, don't you guys agree that the psychological side is by far, I mean, I'm not discounting the whole phenomenon, but the psychological aspect of the phenomenon is what is really the most intriguing part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Not only from person's perception, but what if that person, you know, what if these things that are happening are manifestations of psychokinesis, and that person doesn't really understand it.
Yep, and that's, you know, obviously that's a big part of it. I mean, the human mind is powerful, and it can cause those things, and that's what some of the evidence would suggest. The point is that the answer to can ghosts, spirits, demons hurt you, the answer is no. They can on TV, but they don't in real life. Now, PK... perhaps could be some issue, you know, if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, that is psychokinesis. But folks, ghosts are largely impotent. They can't hardly manifest or even move anything, let alone hurt somebody. And if somebody says, well, you know, one time I got scratched, and I'm, you know, my response is, well, my cat scratches me, so what? You know, well, they yanked on my ponytail. Will they yank on mine? You know, it's like, it's not hurting, they're not harmful. And one of the most important things about being a researcher, being a responsible researcher, is know yourself. You know who you are, have that confidence, and you'll be amazed at how much stuff doesn't happen anymore. And
But you know, too, Doug, I think, and I think you agree with me too, Dave, it's like, who says it has to be dark to do an investigation?
That's coming up. Let's go on to Grant's favorite, number 8, Ouija boards are harmful and can open channels whereby demons and other negative spirits can enter and do harm. What do you think?
Absolute truth. And how can anybody in our audience disagree when Skype has pulled the rug out from underneath us? Seriously, though.
Right. You're about as serious as a...
No, it doesn't open vortexes or portals, and one is not cursed forever if they tried to bring a spirit to the Ouija board.
Ouija boards are nothing but cardboard and plastic. It is a social construct. It is a problem with pop culture. There are researchers who swear by it. Oh, we've seen it happen. You know what? It's not the Ouija board. It's the intent of the person. It's the psychology of the person. There's no difference between a Ouija board and a table with an upside-down glass on it. There's no difference between a Ouija board and a pendulum or dowsing rods or an EMF meter being used as a planchet or being used as a method of communicating with spirits. There's no difference. The fact is that they are nothing. Now, are they a useful investigative tool? Not really. I mean, you know, if you feel like you've got to use one for some odd purpose, then fine. But, you know, there are better things to do. I mean, there are better methods to use. And the biggest problem, in my opinion, with related to not only Ouija boards but demonology, is that there's so many websites that, you know, put this thing up that says, you know, they have that no symbol, you know, the circle with the diagonal line that says no Ouija board. We don't use Ouija boards in our investigations. And I'm thinking, why are you announcing that? It's like, did I miss something here? You know, where do people think that paranormal investigators use Ouija boards automatically?
Actually, yeah.
Well, I must have missed something.
A lot of people just automatically assume paranormal investigations got to do with the occult and summoning.
You could be right there.
A lot of people email me with that.
Well, then I think that they ought to also put the disclaimer that they don't use Native American shaman or African witch doctors.
Sure.
So,
well, I'll tell you what's going to be interesting, guys, is there's a new movie out. I don't know if you've heard about it. It's called Paranormal Activity, and they're using all these scare tactics in the movies, and it's really getting a rise out of the audience, you know. So I'm sure we're going to have a whole rash of investigations after the movies come out, after this movie comes
cool.
out. Yeah, that's okay.
All right, we'll
see how it happens.
Let's go on to number 9. This is the one that you alluded to a little bit ago. The myth is that ghost investigations must be done late at night and in the dark or at certain times of the night. You want to start us out, Grant?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like doing something just because somebody says, nobody can pinpoint where it came from, but we're doing it. Now, we all know the one about, well, the spirits are most active 3 o'clock in the morning and 5 o'clock in the morning. At those beastly and ungodly hours, because nobody else is awake except for ghosts. People who are interested in ghost research or researching paranormal phenomena. But I don't know. Who's to say when paranormal activity might take place? It could happen in broad daylight. One never knows. So I think you got to think out of the box on this one. I really think we need to.
Well, you know, they talk about 3:33 or 3 a.m. being the opposite of when Christ was supposed to have been, you know, crucified there at 3 p.m. So if it's 3 a.m., you know, that's dead time, it's been referred to. Midnight is another popular one. You know, there is some logic in that the world quiets down, and so it's a little easier to do things, and I agree with that. But as Grant pointed out, you know, how many people see these apparitions or have these experiences in broad daylight? It's not just limited to the evening. So you don't have to just go at night. Do it at merits. That's the point.
Yeah, think out of the box though when you approach these investigations. Don't think that you have to do what you've seen people on TV do, or the movies do, or you know, maybe a group that you were formerly with do things. Think out of the box.
Yep. Myth number 10, you need a lot of electronic equipment to conduct an investigation. Anyone?
No. Not yet. No.
No.
That's my simple Canadian answer, no.
We've
had this discussion a couple times already.
Yeah, and I second that notion because bottom line is you don't. And I'm a firm believer that the fewer people you bring into investigation, the better your results may be, or the likelihood of having better results improves.
I know of one group that, you know, they've got 19, 20 members. Now, there's a little bit of an overkill, if you ask me, just as far as manpower. As far as equipment is concerned, yeah, it's nice to have a few things to record any events that happen, you know, your camera, your video recorder, and an EMF detector to eliminate some of the more man-made anomalies. But, you know, you don't need a truck full of equipment.
No. In my opinion, the most important things you can have are your personable people skills, your rational mind, your discernment, and your good judgment. And if you have an audio recorder, that's great, because you can look for EVPs, which in my opinion are among the more meaningful pieces of evidence we can get. Plus, you can also use it to for your interview and take notes, as Dave said. So you don't need much, if anything. Let's go to number 11. Myth number 11, one of my favorites. You must always say a prayer or surround yourself with a circle of light before conducting a haunting investigation. A lot of people believe this. They have some rituals that they go through. And I'll just state my position on this. I don't ever do that, ever, never have, probably never will. Just don't see any need for it. Some people do see a need for it. Now, I'm not saying that you can't have some little ritual you go through to kind of get yourself in the mode, you know, the right frame of mind. I'm going to pause just for a second. We'll let that static go. Sorry about that, folks. The Skype gods are angry at us.
I'm wondering if that's just your connection, Doug. I'm not hearing anything.
You're not hearing anything. Grant, are you hearing anything?
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot of static. Guys.
Yeah, it's coming over your line, Dave. I'm going to... Dave, will you call in on that click the talk button?
Yep, sir.
Thanks. Okay, we're going to have Dave call in on the click-to-talk button. There's just something weird with Skype in Canada tonight, and it was doing pretty good there, but I'll look for Dave to call in on that, and if I don't get it, then we'll call him on the phone and get him back in. Any rate, as I was saying on surrounding yourself with light and that sort of thing, if you have some kind of a method or ritual or something that you use to get yourself into the mindset, into the mode, you know, grounded, balanced, that sort of thing, that's fine. You know, that's not a problem. But the whole circle of light prayers thing, you know, it's really a personal thing. It's really for you. It's, you know, it's not going to do anything or prevent spirits in and of itself from doing their thing. Let's get Dave on. Hey, Dave, you there?
Yeah, you hear me?
Yeah, you're a little bit lower, and there's a little bit of an echo.
Yeah, for some reason my headset's not picking up, so the computer mic is.
I'll let you work on that, and we're going to go on to a related one. Yeah, it sounds like your speaker's coming through and recording again. Number 12. You must sage yourself after an investigation to cleanse yourself of spirit attachments. Otherwise, ghosts, spirits, and negative entities can follow you home. If you can lower your speakers, Dave a little bit. That might help with the echo.
How's that?
I'll try it. It's a little bit better. This is one I've commented on the show. A lot of people, I mean, I've heard a lot of people say this, that they are afraid that a spirit might follow them home from an investigation, and that would be a bad thing. And my response is, I'm afraid that a spirit won't follow me home. I mean, think about it. Spirit followed me home, I could do research right here at the comfort of my own home. That's kind of cool, huh?
You could do the dishes at my house, or I love the dishwasher. You know, I mean, put them to good use.
That's right.
You know, I don't know, Doug. I've never been followed home like a puppy by a ghost, but I've known lots of people that we've come across in the business that really believe that.
I've invited them to come home with me. They just won't come home.
They know better.
Yeah, I'll put them to work like you would.
That's right. But quite seriously, though, there's a lot of people that really believe that. That's a true thing. And, you know, I'd just like to make a comment, too, though, if we can digress for a moment, and that's in regards to doing the prayer of the circle of life and doing all that kind of stuff. That's going in with a preconceived notion, in my mind.
Yeah.
You've got to protect yourself. Against what?
Yeah. What are they going to do to you? Startle you? I mean, okay. After that phase, then I'd like to talk to him. I got some questions. Any comments, Dave?
No. I'm still working on tech issues here.
Okay. Well, you let me know when you're ready to jump in. So in terms of worrying about whether a spirit's going to follow you home, that's just not a non-issue. Honestly, again, if you know who you are, you know why you are who you are, and you have that self-confidence, they're not going to do that. And even if you invite them to, they don't. I mean, that's just been my experience. And as far as saging your house, again, that is a belief system support. It supports your own belief system. You know, if you believe it, then it's true for you. So if you believe that saging yourself is going to somehow cleanse yourself in your home or whatever from spirits, then it will, because that's your belief system. If you believe that putting oil, anointing oil on different places on the doorways and wherever in your home, that's going to help. Well, then it will, because that's what you believe. If you believe that sprinkling holy water in the name of the Holy Trinity, you know, the Doug, the Grant, the Dave, will help, then that will. I do that all the time.
Doug used to carry a squirt gun full of holy water.
I never did get a sprinkler. I always wanted one. Okay. So, again, just it's not saging. I mean, do it if you think it's going to work, but that's it only works because you think it will. Number 13, if you cannot readily explain an anomaly in a photo or a video, it's likely paranormal in nature. Now, we touched on this earlier on in the program. If we're in some other venue, a baseball game or at a party or something, and we take a picture and we get some funky anomaly, are we going to automatically think it's a spirit? Probably not. Just because we're on an investigation doesn't necessarily mean that whatever we get is going to be, you know, paranormal in nature, and likely it's not. We've talked about this part of anomalous research in the past and reinventing the field. We need meaningful evidence, and frankly, pictures and video are almost worthless in terms of paranormal evidence. Unfortunately, they can be faked and hoaxed really easily, and they're all but impossible to prove. And so, you know, when we use Occam's razor, the simplest explanation is likely the correct one, and parsimony, you know, that the simplest explanation is it, we're left with no other way out. So don't just assume that whatever you've captured is paranormal.
And by the same token, don't embellish what you've captured to make it paranormal.
Because
if you're doing that, you don't belong in research.
Yeah, no embellishment.
You take the findings the way that they are, and you present them that way. Don't sex it up.
And this is this is one of the reasons why we are having to fake the photo contest that's currently going on, and you know we're hoping that people will take advantage of that. Why not try to fake a photo? And the details are on Paranexus.org. You know, go check it out and submit a photo for that you've hoaxed. The whole point of this is for educational purposes. We can show how they're hoaxed, and you know, we've got some good prizes for winners. I mean, we've got three total winners. The first place winner is going to get a year membership of Paranexus, and the first and second place winners are going to come on the show and talk to us about how they faked the photo. So go check.
And boy, will you be sorry. We'll just scare you that up. Seriously. It's really something that we hope that you folks will, to quote Pat Benatar, hit us with your best shot.
Yeah. We'd love to see him. All right, let's get into number 14. Now we're going to take a little bit of a departure away from ghost-related stuff. The last two, 14 and 15, have to do with the abduction phenomena. And this is something that has been in the works for us in some of our inner discussions for a while, especially with Mike Jones and so forth. But here's the myth. Millions of people are being abducted by aliens for the nefarious purposes of genetic testing and hybridization with a goal of world domination. Now, let me give some basis for this point, some foundation. Back in 1991, there was a Roper poll that was authored by abduction researchers Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs. By the way, David Jacobs was on our program last fall. And those two, along with sociologist Ron Westrum, indicated from this poll, after they kind of deciphered it, that their interpretation was that 3.7 million Americans, or 2% of the population they were sampling, which was 185 million, but 3.7 million Americans were alien abductees. They showed all the signs. Obviously, this interpretation, you know, has been the subject of a lot of criticism by scientists and researchers in various disciplines. But what we want to do is we want to put on our rational thinking mind and look at this thing. There's a number of big problems with this whole concept that millions of people are being abducted. Now, if you want all the math and the details, then go to Paranexus.org, look under the recent blogs, and you'll see my blog. There are two parts to it, and it's Responsible Research Separating Fact from Fiction. You can read the math that I've got on here. But basically, after doing the math and figuring out what kind of logistics would it take to abduct a million people. Now, I assumed a couple of things because there's just really no data on it. Let's assume, for example, that these abductees are being taken one time per year. Now, we also know from reports that, you know, they can be taken several times a year. But let's just assume that it's one time a year. That means that to abduct 1 million people, only, not 3.7, but 1 million people, that would mean that 114 people are being abducted, tested, and returned every hour of every day, 365 days per year. So how many ships would it take? How many crew members would it take? Well, you know, if they're taking only one person at a time, it would obviously take 114 different ships. But let's assume they're taking five people at a time, five humans. In this case, they'd need 23 ships and a crew working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, around the year, nonstop, to do this thing. But let's expand this. This is where it gets even more interesting. The United States is not the only country in the world. Let's expand that 3.7 million Americans figure, extrapolate it, to represent the entire world. And again, the figures are in my blog article if you want to look at them. I'm going to bring it down and give you the nitty-gritty that if we extrapolate that, that means that we're looking at 79 million plus people being abducted worldwide every year. And that's one time per year. If we figure out how many ships does it take to do that, we're talking about 1,822 separate ships working nonstop around the clock every day of the year. That means that 9,041 people are being abducted every hour of every day worldwide without a break. Now, if we assume a skeleton crew of, say, 8 members, including the doctors and whoever, the drones, you know, we're talking about 14,576 aliens involved 24 hours a day, no breaks, round the clock, 365 days a year. If we assume that there's three eight-hour shifts, now we're talking about a crew of 43,000 members plus. So what about the infrastructure that it would take to support such a thing? Well, let's compare it to the U.S. Navy. At the end of 2008, the U.S. Navy had 283 ships in active service with over 330,000 personnel to support that. Now, that averages out to 1,172 personnel per Navy ship. If we extrapolate the same figures, use it as a basis, we're talking about an alien infrastructure of over 2 million individuals. So think about that. Just to abduct what some of these polls are saying, or the numbers being abducted. Now, when we think about this, does it make sense? Does it have a ring of truth? If you had a force of over 2 million strong with advanced technology, you know, I'm thinking, what's the best way of dominating the world? You know, take decades, yeah, if not hundreds or even thousands. Go ahead, Dave.
Well, with all those figures, I mean, begs the question, why take a person here, a person there, when if you're working with those numbers, you can just take over?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there's
all. Why put in all those man hours?
Yeah. I mean, you could essentially get rid of most of the human race, keep a few for testing, and, you know, get the job done. Now,
but you know too, Doug, the thing that is that why would any, I mean, you can do, we all know simple statistics where you can draw and get a sample, a smaller sample out of a large population, and you can, at that point in time, actually get some idea of what total demographics are, just out of a small population. So that would be completely counterproductive to doing any serious long-term, longitudinal, you know, sophisticated research project on this.
Yeah.
Be counterproductive.
And it just doesn't make rational sense. Now, I do want to point out that this having been said, it's not that we don't believe that abductions are a possibility. I mean, we've had Mike Jones on the show many times, and he's hosting a show a month on that topic. And there are some cases that are very compelling. It's just that abductions, probably more than almost anything else, you really have to rule out the client's psychology, other reasons for it. I mean, there's sleep paralysis. There's a host of different things that could result in that belief. So that's just something to be aware of. And I don't, in terms of researching abductions, you need to kind of know what you're doing and learn as much as you can learn and use your own good judgment and rational mind when it comes to that. And don't be too quick to pronounce somebody an abductee. Really, you got to get to know them. Any other comments on that one?
All right.
None for me. I think it's covered it pretty good.
Let's consider the very last myth we're going to talk about tonight, and that is, again, related to abductions, but it's really focused on hypnosis. And the myth is that hypnosis should not be used in aiding abductees to recall abduction experiences. Now, there are many researchers, many of them in the UK, who don't believe that hypnosis is a useful tool. And I agree and disagree both at the same time. As a certified hypnotist, and having had a practice, hypnosis can be a great tool, but that's all it is. And just because somebody relates something under hypnosis does not set it in stone, does not mean that it actually happened. And there's also the false memory syndrome that can be brought to bear if the hypnotist is not, they don't get it. I mean, I'm here to tell you, I've read about some popular researchers who use hypnosis, and I've read their transcripts, and I was rather shocked to see language that essentially is leading the witness, or leading the subject, rather. You cannot do that. That is an absolute biggest mistake, is leading the witness. You never introduce something in hypnosis that hasn't already been introduced by the subject. You never do that. Never ask leading questions. And as a hypnotist, you know, hypnosis is 5% learning how to put somebody into a trance, 95% on how good you are at interpreting the data, at making sure that you don't lead them, making sure you don't introduce spurious stuff. And it can be tough. It can be challenging. There have been times when I just couldn't ask the question because I couldn't determine a way to ask it without introducing additional information. For example, you could say to the subject, you're entering a room now. Tell me when you're there. Okay, I'm there. What color is it? What color are the walls? You'd think, well, that's not harmful. They're going to have a color. But, you know, you got to be careful of that. Or tell me what kind of control panels are on the walls. You know, that's assumptions. So you have to be really careful. You have to learn how to distinguish reality from fantasy. And that's not always very easy to do. So you got to be very careful of using it, although I do believe that it is a useful tool. Any comments, guys?
Well, I'm no expert on hypnosis by any stretch of the imagination, but I do know, some of the accusations that have been made about some very famous researchers and how they conducted hypnosis. And I think that hypnosis is an extremely valuable tool as long as it's the person who's doing it is ethical and they're knowledgeable.
And they're not trying to prove a pet theory.
Absolutely. They're not biased. And,
right.
And they know, and you know somebody who's good at the practice of hypnotism because they have to have an ethical guideline.
Mm-hmm.
Because some people are very suggestible and they can be exploited. And so, but the thing about hypnosis is very, very interesting and the results are fascinating. Just that you have to be careful and you have to let it unfold itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like that person that's just revealing parts of their unconsciousness. And you have to not only be careful of the questions you ask, but once again, always be careful that you don't do anything that's going to upset them or cause anxiety.
Yeah. So the whole point of this discussion tonight is that we need to be responsible in our research, and that means separating fact from fiction. It means not trying to prove a pet theory, not going in with an advanced hypothesis and trying to prove it. Now, you can set up experiments to test a hypothesis. That's different. But we can't have this thing where we're just going to prove it and ignore other evidence, which is unfortunately a bit common in the scientific world. Remember, what is, and we really shouldn't have to go out on a limb to prove paranormal events. We just got to keep working at it. Any quick final comments? We're going to last a minute and a half.
Credibility, credibility, credibility.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
That's what it boils down to. It's your morals, your credibility, your reliability. This is you that's on the line. If you're a researcher, and what you stand for, Doug and Grant have said, if you're going to fake stuff, your credibility, your reputation, everything is out the window. It's not worth it.
No, don't sacrifice your reputation on things that are not based in fact. Now, before we go real quick, I just wanted to invite folks to visit paranexus.org. We are now a nonprofit corporation. We are making a lot of changes and advances and improvements and growing. We'd love to have you as a member. You get free web hosting with it and a number of other benefits. In fact, we just put up tonight a research assistant with a lot of different tools on the web page. And if you're a member, you can gain access to that. We appreciate everybody's time tonight. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
And Grant, as always, next week, Mark Anthony's Psychic Perspective will be with us. Folks, have a great night.
Have a great weekend, everybody.
Good night, all.
It's Paramex's universe.